Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business episode 358. My name's Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by the fine, fine folks at Thinxt Applied Research, and you'll be hearing from Thinxt head honcho Haroon Mir a little bit later on in this week's sponsor interview. He'll be recapping his keynote speech from the Troopers Conference in Germany. That is very interesting stuff. This week's feature guest is H.D. Moore, bringing the total number of people with the initials H.M. in this week's show to two. H.D. and Haroon are both joining me this week to essentially talk about the same thing, a big picture rethink of what the hell this industry is doing with itself. We're going to look at some of the real problems and what some of the real solutions could be. I throw my two cents in about what could actually get us there, like, you know, people caring about these issues, for example. But I wonder what could happen that would make people care. A realistic scenario that's pretty grim. I wonder.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison has approved a multi-billion dollar bailout package for TNE Bank following the institution's collapse after the so-called Angry Pigeon cyber attacks in February. The emergency relief is expected to delay the introduction of the coalition's planned income tax cuts until the year 2017.
Yep, I reckon that'd do it. That'd probably result in some concrete action, but could it happen? Stay tuned to find out. Oh, and sorry for putting the image of Scott Morrison as PM into your heads, but you know, that was supposed to be an imagined headline from a dystopian yet believable future, so I couldn't resist. Anyway, let's get into the news now, where we speak with Adam Boileau about the wonderful and not so wonderful things that have happened in the InfoSec world over the last week. And Adam, there's been a bit of action on the old dark market scene. German police have busted this group who were very apparently prominent members of the Evolution Forum, apparently running their own thing as well. But there's a photo accompanying this story of the seized drugs, and I'm guessing it's a steel table because that's a lot of drugs.
Yeah, something like 350 kilos of pills and drugs and all sorts of other things piled up on the table that police in Leipzig in Germany have seized from these guys. These were they were apparently called Shiny Flakes, was their name on Evolution, and were, you know, a relatively successful vendor in that marketplace. They also ran, as you say, their own operation as well. They had a Tor hidden service and a regular website where you could buy drugs. So
that sounds like a great idea.
It does sound like a great idea, but apparently they've picked up 20-something-year-old German man and another Bulgarian guy who was the courier, and they've taken them down.
Yeah, I mean, you look at this photo and you're like, that's more than a big weekend. I mean, if they were in the US, I'm imagining they would have been imprisoned forever. But being in Germany, we'll just have to see. But yikes, man, that's a lot of drugs. And, you know, Evolution, 2 days after this bust was announced, Evolution just disappeared.
Yeah, now this is an interesting story. Of course, you know, we speculated when the Silk Road got taken down, and we saw some of the other busts against dark market site recently, that, you know, Agora and Evolution were the ones that were left standing, and, you know, you would assume that some kind of natural selection process, that these are the ones that were actually doing it right. But Evolution is gone, and apparently relatively recently they said, oh, we're having some problems with our Bitcoin exchange process, so no one can withdraw money for a little bit. And then
the hidden service just vanished.
And then the hidden service just disappears.
But I'm thinking if it is a case that the admins have just burned all of their customers and pissed off, I mean, that would be the sensible thing to do. You would have to be nuts to keep running one of these things for more than 18 months or, you know, a few years, because it's obvious that law enforcement will eventually close in. You've had one of your major vendors busted. I'm thinking now's probably a good time to punch out. And if you can take a few million dollars with you, hey, why not?
Well, exactly right. And that, it, you know, it does kind of smell of an exit strategy. And if you were, you know, if you were a nice person, then maybe you wouldn't, you know.
Well, maybe you wouldn't run a huge illicit drug market in the first place, Adam, you know, selling stolen credit cards and stuff as well.
You might, yes, you might not do that. And of course, yeah, even the Evolution, you know, was known for selling things that were, you know, I was going to say, didn't live up to the ethical standard of the Silk Road, but that's a pretty rough thing to say.
Yeah, that's a pretty low bar. car to begin with, isn't
it? But yeah, so they, no one has seemed particularly clear quite how much money we're talking about. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you have to have an exit strategy, and this seems as good as any. Although, you know, just turning the site off, you know, I imagine people could live with, but you're going to make a lot of enemies in one go with this. I mean, you know, you've got the
But apart from that, like if you've handled your anonymity to a reasonable degree, I mean, what's the consequence here? I mean, you're ripping off criminals because your customers are criminals. So what's the problem? I can't see that it isn't sound strategy.
I mean, it is pretty hard to argue. Like, if your OPSEC is good enough to stop the police, it's hopefully good enough to stop, you know, most of your customers who are now pissed off. Mm. And yeah, I mean, you know, what are the criminals going to do, right? Go phone the police?
Yeah, probably not. So, yeah, we'll just have to see if they've been taken down because they are on the lam, you know, if the police are actually going to start putting out warrants for people. You know, we just don't know at this stage. But what we can say is Evolution is gone, which is going to piss off a whole bunch of so-called threat intelligence people who spend all of their days trawling for information that they can use to ambulance chase with. massive blow to the threat intelligence business.
Well, I'm sure Agora will take up the slack or something, and we'll see where this heads.
Now, you know, we reported on the Anthem breach of a few weeks ago, which is this giant health insurance firm in the United States. They lost data on something like 100 million of their customers. It looks like there's been another health records related breach, and you know, this is interesting. 11 million customer records apparently have gone in this one. This is called Primera, this company. What I find interesting about all of these health sector attacks is last year, a lot of analysts were actually predicting, a lot of sort of prominent people in the industry were predicting that healthcare providers like these guys were going to have a rough time of it. And when do these predictions ever pan out? I mean, this is almost a good news story because it means the analysts know what they're talking about.
Actually, you're right. You found the silver lining in this particular story that, who knew that actual predictions made by, you know, the security industry would be accurate. That's amazing. That's truly a wonderful, groundbreaking news there. The interesting thing I thought about this story actually is that this company, Primera and Anthem, both actually were told or found out about their respective breaches on the same day as the result of some indicators of compromise provided by the FBI during,
that's interesting.
You know, when they published some information saying, you know, people are targeting the healthcare sector, here's some indicators of compromise, and these two organizations have found it at the same point in time. Of course, the disclosure timelines are a bit different between these two things, as is the nature of the data taken. But it kind of underscores the stories you hear around the industry, which is that, you know, the vast majority of organizations who find out they've been compromised do so because somebody outside tells them, not through internal, you know, detection or response capability.
Well, this is a little bit of both, though. I mean, if it's an indicator of compromise, it's not like their data popped up on Evolution and some threat intel jerk said, hey, I'll sell it back to you and do my recovery services for $300,000, you know?
Seeing a theme here, but yes, yeah, carry on.
But you know what I mean, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah. I mean, it may be that they had the tools in place to take that data and act upon the property and find something, or maybe they just got lucky, or, you know. Yeah, but then I thought that was an interesting bit to the story that, you know, is right in the last, buried in the last paragraph of this particular piece on Wired.
Yeah. Now, you know, the Let's Encrypt initiative is coming up midway through this year, and I really think this is going to have a massive impact on the SSL space. And, you know, with that in mind, Ars Technica is running a series of pieces about something very embarrassing that happened to Microsoft in Finland. You know, a little bit Microsoft's fault, a little bit Komodo's fault, but some guy just signed up for, like, Hostmaster at live.fi and then, like, got a Komodo cert for live.fi and... You know, he was able to man in the middle if he wanted to. He just did it for shits and giggles, basically. but yeah, that's just, it just goes to show like how broken our current SSL model is. And, you know, again, even if they revoke the certificate, if you've got the certificate that this guy's got and the key that goes with it, you know, all you have to do is block people from getting the revocation lists, which if you're man in the middle and you're man in the middle and you're in a position to do that anyway. So this is basically going to be a problem for all eternity for, you know, I mean,
No, you're exactly right. That is it in a nutshell. You know, domain control validation certs that rely on control of hostmaster or postmaster or you know, abuse at or admin at. You know, it's just a rubbish way of issuing certs in the first place. And this happened in this particular story in live.fi, but but ours has also turned up. Someone who did the same thing in Belgium to Microsoft's live.be
administrator at live.be. Yeah, nice.
Yeah. But I mean, this is the thing we've, you know, we've come across in our work. I mean, I'm pretty sure we've reported to customers that run things where, you know, arbitrary users can create mail aliases or create account names, like registering, you know, account names that are nominally privileged is a thing we do write people up
but
for.
This but this is a 90s thing. Like, the people have been doing this forever, which is like, oh, webmail. Like, I remember had, you know, .com or whatever, you know, you just sign up for a whole bunch of official. Anyway, I should probably stop talking now, but there were other cases where this was done. And I just you just think people would know, I guess, that, you know, those there are certain key addresses that just need to be registered, and, you know, even if not directed to an actual mailbox, you just need to dev null them or reserve them.
Yeah, but you got to remember to do that all the time, consistently everywhere, even in Finland, right, or even in Belgium, which I guess is the difficult bit. And of course, I don't even know what the list of, like, I mean, the RFC, which says these are the, you know, the names that are magical, doesn't necessarily map 100% onto the lists that are going to be used by every CA vendor, or every CA everywhere, right? Which is, I mean, it's a hard problem to solve for a number of reasons, all of which are dumb, I might add.
Yeah, but I mean, this just goes back, I guess, to the whole thing of SSL is, we're all ruined as far as SSL is concerned, and it's time for a serious rethink. And, you know, what I'm hoping happens is that there's a mass migration towards the Let's Encrypt thing. And once you've got sort of a critical mass there, those guys can start setting the standards instead of the CA industry. Do you know what I mean? And once you've got a sensible consortium staffed with sensible people who go, you know what, we're going to change the way revocation happens. Guess what? You know, it happens. And then the CAs sort of have to fall into line. So that's really what I'm hoping comes out of this.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I mean, the current way that that governance happens, which is like through some, you know, industry body that is, you know, funded by CA vendors and has a couple of browser vendors on it who make no money out of it, you know, that's obviously not a governance model that works. And the alternatives, you know, DNSSEC rooted trust would be nice, but, you know, that's a whole.
You know what else is nice? You know what else is nice? Unicorns. Ponies. Unicorns that piss beer and shit gold nuggets. They're nice. They are. Magic carpets. Magic beans. Magic beans are nice. They're good. Now switching over to Washington, D.C., and there's a little bit of action going on over there. The Obama administration is trying to expand some of its powers in how it can tackle botnets, and this actually looks pretty eminently sensible in the what they're doing. I mean, at the moment, they can apply for court orders and injunctions and whatnot if botnets are doing certain specific things, like wire fraud. You know, they have to be able to make the case under that law. What they're looking to do is expand the law so that if they're sending spam, if they're doing crypto locker stuff, you know, they can also apply for those injunctions. This just seems like a very small but very sensible reform, which will allow the DOJ and even companies like Microsoft who go after botnets, it'll allow them to go after wider types of malware families.
Yeah, it does seem like that it's an artificial, you know, restriction that they're currently facing of having to prove that it has a particular, you know, a particular type of crime being carried out where, you know, clearly a botnet can change what it does daily, and so it doesn't make a whole bunch of sense to do that. But, I mean, then the they are also proposing that they would be able to use this for botnets that consist of 100 or more machines being compromised. Like, that's a pretty small botnet. So, I mean, the balance between, you know, making it not you know, ridiculously easy to abuse this particular power versus having something that actually does meet the needs of law enforcement. You know, if they can find that balance, then yeah, great. That does seem like an improvement.
Yep. Staying in Washington, and CISPA, the highly controversial CISPA Act, is back, and now it's called CISA. So they lost the P. And, you know, people are still screaming about it, saying there's horrible privacy problems with it. I mean, essentially, it facilitates sharing between the private sector and the FBI and stuff like that. You know, the concern is that it's too loosely worded and could sort of be used for nefarious purposes by various agencies in collusion with the private sector. And, you know, pre-Snowden, I probably would have said that was a bit far-fetched. But these days, yeah, I'm not so sure. And, you know, some of the concerns raised look pretty legitimate to me.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the, you know, the fact we've been making fun of threat intelligence so far this episode, I guess, kind of fits in quite well. I mean, essentially, that's what this is supposed to be about, which is providing some way to get data out of, you know, where it is inside, you know, the Yahoos and the Googles and that kind of thing, and into a place where it can be acted upon and looked at from a central point of view, i.e. the government, and doing that in a way that doesn't go horribly wrong, as Snowden shows, right, is not quite a thing that we've managed to figure out yet. But, you know, it's...
You know what else is nice?
Let me guess. Unicorns, yes.
Dear. I mean, is this something that can be fixed? That's the thing. I mean, can you have information sharing where the privacy protections you know, and I'm not just talking from a technical sense, I'm talking from a legal sense, where they're actually adequate. I mean, it's a tough one. I just don't see how you could really do it well.
No, but it's a very difficult balance to strike. And like doing the minimization and the reduction and anonymization of data is very difficult to do effectively. We've seen, you know, well, I think we've even reported upon studies where, you know, de-anonymizing or de-minimizing that data, you know, through large patent analysis, that kind of thing, is actually something that people can and do. And of course, we're learning a lot about big data, I suppose, in the industry and turning this kind of thing into something useful without having it go horribly wrong is, yeah.
Oh, well, let's see. I mean, I don't think it's actually law yet. So let's just see if it winds up amended to turn into, you know, building an escalator up the Grand Canyon or yeah, something.
Well, exactly, you know? Right. I mean, American legal, you know, law generation process does seem rather strange.
Yes. And that's how a bill becomes a law. It might wind up turning into a bill that legalizes cyanide-tipped armor-piercing bullets. Who knows? Oh, look, I don't really want to spend too much time on this, but, you know, there's certainly a lot of freak news still around. Of course, a lot of mobile Android and iOS apps are still vulnerable to Freak. I don't think that's necessarily that surprising, and it's something that should be fixed. But there's, you know, there's just a lot of freak news. There's also a news story here carried on ThreatPost that said, you know, people have figured out a way to make these freak attacks a lot easier. They've cheapened the attacks, essentially, so less bruting time.
Yeah, I thought one of the things that stood out for me in the coverage that ThreatPost is running on Freak is that they went through and sampled the apps out of the Google Play Store and the Apple App Store looking for statically compiled OpenSSL, i.e. things that are going to continue to be vulnerable despite the underlying OS being patched.
Yeah.
And those numbers were like 10% on Google Play and 7 out of 14,000 on the iOS App Store. So, yeah, that's a data point for you.
Yes, that is a data point. How have these smart people, they are researchers from Royal Holloway University in London, how have they figured out how to make the attack a little bit more workable?
So one of the things they did was they went around and they looked for keys that share common factors or things that they can use to shortcut some of the factorization process. They went around and scanned the internet and managed to figure out that there are a number of devices which either generate keys using the same entry pool during boot or use straight up the same key. So then you can use that as an optimization when you're trying to deal with factoring the rubbish export grade certs that are used and exploited during the freak process.
Mm. Moving on, and Yahoo, at the most recent Black Hat USA conference back last year, was that July, August, Alex Stamos got up and said, hey, guess what? We're going to introduce encrypted mail. Looks like that's actually happening. They've got end-to-end email encryption. They've got an extension for that. It's there. They've previewed it.
Yeah, and this is a great thing. Obviously, people need to actually go ahead and then use it. But anything that makes end-to-end crypto, you know, more easily available, as we've seen with, you know, WhatsApp rolling out end-to-end crypto, that kind of thing, iMessage, you know, if it does get used, this does make a real difference. Certainly, the idea that they have been cooperating with Google and open sourcing some of the components is a really good step. It's kind of nice to see Yahoo doing relevant things.
It is. I mean, I just wonder though, when you're using webmail. Like how useful it is in, you know, in defending against warranted access, because there's no reason, technically I'm speaking about, not legally or anything else, there's no reason, once you control the display, once you control what a user sees, you know, it's going to be easy to sort of game it a little bit, isn't it, to sort of trick people into thinking that they're doing things that they're not doing, for example.
Well, yes. I mean, that is, of course, the problem with trusting you know, your software supply chain being pulled down every time you use it off the web you know, versus having to do longer-term supply chain attacks on PGP or something to get around that in the same way. And we have to be able to rely on, you know, on Yahoo or Google to go full love a bit, right, on if they do get a warrant. And, you know, that's a – well, I guess that's a judgment of the individual users to take, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's...
And maybe the shareholders.
Well, I mean, you know, we've even seen, you know, Alex Stamos, you know, discussing this stuff with Admiral Mike Rogers on panels and stuff. So, you know, interesting area. This is one move, though, isn't it? Which is Yahoo have actually released their encryption extension. Staying with Yahoo, they've got an idea. I'm not sure what I think about this. I think what it does is it actually shifts your risk to a different set of attackers. But what they're doing is...
I concur, yes.
What they're doing is you now have the option to use... Well, they're saying it's second-factor authentication without the first factor. So you just use your username and then hit give me an SMS and then you get an OTP via SMS, which, again, I mean, that protects you against someone, you know, pulling your creds out of a data dump, which is probably your number one risk for your average user. But then again, like if your crazy ex-girlfriend manages to get a hold of your phone... they're going to be able to log into your email if you've got like previews popping up on the screen of your smartphone, for example. So yeah, solve some problems, create some others. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why we have two factors of auth, not just one factor. And what I've done is replace a rubbish one factor, i.e. passwords, with another rubbish one factor SMS delivery, which has, I mean, as you say, a bunch of different attack surface. But I suppose the, you know, maybe it's moved it to be slightly less Yahoo's problem and slightly more somebody else's problem. You know, the very, very big password breaches we saw, you know, did result in a lot of people getting compromise. So, you know, if it solves that problem, then maybe it works. But yeah, overall, I don't think I would feel comfortable with, you know, single factor out of band SMS.
Well, no, you wouldn't, but would your grandmother?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, would you recommend it for your grandmother?
Probably not, I don't think.
Well, we must not forget that, of course, your grandmother is a veteran of, you know, 10 DEF CONs and keynote speaker at SciScan 3 years in a row. So, you know, of course, there's that.
My now, grandma's not Brett Moore.
Ours, again, some great stories on ours this week, by the way. But there was an interesting little BGP snafu, you might call it, which saw a whole bunch of defense industrial traffic routed briefly through Kiev, which is probably not what you want when you're designing, you know, helicopter parts and bomb components.
No,
nuclear bomb components, I should point out.
Yeah, this included the one of the defense atomic weapons establishment agencies in the UK having their traffic tromboned out through the Ukraine and back again. Doesn't seem like a great thing. Of course, it just illustrates you know, what we've known for a long time, which is that BGP does require quite a lot of trust on the backbone, and things can and do go horribly wrong. And of course, combined with rubbish PKI and SSL, this is bad.
This is what happens, yes. And yes. Staying with all things nuclear, South Korea apparently has charged that North Korea hacked a whole bunch of data on one of their nuclear plants, including employee data. They stole some blueprints and threatened to blow it up if their demands weren't met. I mean, it sounds pretty North Korea.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, it sounds like pretty much situation normal. Of course, you know, if someone hacks South Korea in anything, you would imagine that North Korea is first on the list of suspects. And apparently there was some similarity in the malware. And of course, the some of the demands looked a bit similar to the sort of the Sony debacle. But yeah, we don't really know, but seems plausible.
Sadly, it does. Twitter has been copping a bit of flack lately, and this is a tricky one because you can sort of see it from both sides. Quite often when someone's logging in via a Tor exit node these days, they're actually being prompted for a phone number, which kind of kills the anonymity provided by Tor. Twitter has fired back and said, well, actually, we're only asking for those phone numbers in accounts that look like they're, you know, abusive accounts, or, you know, they're likely to be sending spam. So it's, I guess, the Tor exit nodes, you know, if you see someone coming in from a Tor exit node, you know, they could either be legitimate or someone could be using Tor for nefarious purposes to set up scamming accounts and spam accounts and abuse accounts and things like that. So it's a pretty tricky situation for them.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're stuck, right? Because, I mean, either you really need Tor or you're being a jerk over Tor, and there isn't much middle ground. And, you know, you have collateral damage whichever way you deal with it. I mean, it kind of sounds like they're using the fact that it's coming from a Tor exit node as part of sort of a reputation system and deciding whether they have to do some kind of second factor or much the same way that banks do for fraud and stuff. And, yeah, you can certainly see it from both sides. And, you know, Tor, well, Twitter needs to you know, I guess figure out some better way of doing it other than, you know, punishing the people who, you know, people who are using Tor because they need it aren't having a great experience, you know, to start with of life or the world or the web or freedom. So, you know, making it worse for them is maybe a thing they should consider a little more deeply.
Yeah, but I mean, then how do you differentiate between legit and non-legit accounts? And it's, you know, a lot of those non-legit accounts are going to be funneled through Tor. So, I mean, I'm kind of on the side of people who are saying they shouldn't be doing this. Do you know what I mean? They should continue to allow you know, this sort of anonymous access to the accounts. But at the same time, I'm pretty sympathetic towards their security teams who have to face that reality, the reality of allowing blanket access unauthenticated from Tor exit nodes. Yeah, so if you're listening, guys, good luck with that one. In what could turn into a lulz fest over the next few years, Facebook Messenger is now allows you to send money to friends. And, you know, the one thing that I think is, like, this just makes Facebook accounts and the compromise of Facebook accounts so much more valuable to attackers. So, you know, I'd be bracing if I were the Facebook team. I'd be bracing for the number of attempted account compromises to just go through the roof.
It seems like one of these things that's going to be a really good case study of how the economics of changing the value or something like this affects cybercrime. Mm. You know, I think we'll be able to look back in a year and then we'll have an idea of whether this really does make such a big difference, because you imagine it's going to. And actually, one of the things I think is interesting about this is that they are specifically requiring that you link your account to a debit card, not a credit card, for these transactions. So if you do manage to gain access to someone's Facebook account, then you're actually hitting their real money. Like, it's not credit card money that you can charge back or claim or something like that. It's real money. And you imagine that's more valuable than credit card money.
You'd think the audit trail would be pretty good in something like this, but I take over your account. I secretly, as secretly and stealthily as I can, I friend me, you know, or one of the accounts that I control. You know, I wait a while, I transfer some money across. I mean, getting it out of the Facebook ecosystem without any alarms being raised. I mean, then again, when you're friends with someone, you can tell when they're off camping or whatever. So, I mean, we've seen those scams too, where, you know, you take over a Facebook account and you say, oh, hey, it's me, I'm in London and someone mugged me and I got no money. Wire me some money through Western Union. I mean, this is just a much more direct way to monetize them. But anyway, Microsoft, Windows 10, they've got a new way of logging in. I mean, they're relying heavily on biometrics, which could either be awesome or really, really bad. I'm guessing that if it was me, I'd want to use a biometric and a password. But, you know, they're allowing you just to log in with your face, your finger or your iris. So that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we seem to have a bunch of stories this week which are all, you know, it could go bad, it could go wrong. It's a hard thing to juggle these two options. But yeah, adding biometrics to everything. I mean, if we saw very big rollouts in corporate environments of biometrics, you could see that solving some real problems that corporates have. I mean, you know, I guess, you know, us pen testers see a lot of rubbish corporate password lists. Mm. And if you could solve that problem, then you would be doing the world a favor. But on the other hand, right, actually doing biometrics on a really large scale in business, like, that's a problem that, well, we don't know. I guess we don't really know exactly what problems that's going to cause, but I imagine there's going to be quite a few.
Well, Adam, I mean, you just got to think of the consequences. You're incentivizing attackers to hack off the target's head and hold it in front of the onboard camera. And, you know, the number of murders that we could see as a result of Microsoft's irresponsible decision making, I mean, God, it could be a homicide, homicide epidemic. The New York Times is carrying a really interesting story, actually, about the JP Morgan Chase hack. This story says that the attack wasn't nearly as sophisticated as was initially thought, and several of the suspects in the case are actually what they're calling gettable, which presumably just means based outside of Russia. So they're anticipating some arrests, which would be not very happy days for those guys if they do get caught.
No, and I guess it's the law enforcement has to prioritize those cases where they think they might actually have some chance of getting something. Mm. And if they were going after something that was as high profile as this and getting somewhere, then that's, I guess that is a good sign and a good use of their resources. Certainly the fact that the attackers weren't super sophisticated is somewhat reinforced by some descriptions of the work that JP Morgan have been doing to remedy their network since then, which includes, for example, patching things.
Yes.
Yeah.
That tends to help. Removing really obvious SQL injection from front pages and maybe firewalling away the admin interface to your load balancer.
Interesting, actually. They were talking about now implementing second factor auth for admins and that kind of thing internally, which is something, of course, we encourage our customers to do. So it's glad to see that. I'm glad to see that, you know, other people are also doing that.
Yeah.
Obviously JP Morgan Chase had a pretty bad time of it.
Well, and the attackers only got access to email addresses and phone numbers for 83 million households and small business, which I guess, you know, it is useful data, but it's only so useful and certainly not worth 20 years in prison useful. So we'll just see how that plays out. Now, of course, we've mentioned the Hillary Clinton email thing and we're all like laughing at her going, lol, 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 she was running a really insecure send mail box or whatever. Turns out the State Department in the US has actually taken its entire email network offline, you know, just in case. There's no evidence of a breach here. We just thought we'd take it down because, you know, better safe than sorry. So it looks like they're dealing with something pretty awful.
Little light spring cleaning, that's all, yeah. Actually, I will remind you that when we covered the Hillary Clinton story, I said that the State Department network probably isn't any better.
Yes, you did.
So I feel somewhat vindicated by, that extremely, reliable prediction.
No, you called it. You called it. But yes, it's all down. So that's fun, I'm sure, for all of the staff at the US State Department. Mm-hmm. Now, we're just going to move through some bugs now. There's bits of research that says the persistent DLL hijacking actually works against OS X, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I haven't seen the raw resets, but reading the stories about it does suggest that it's you can configure application, or if you have an application that is configured to use an insecure load path for libraries in much the same way that traditionally was by default runnable on Windows, and then you could do if you set your LD preload wrong in Linux, cause it to load libraries out of a directory that was untrusted. And that seems to be the focus of this particular research, and it has identified a number of apps which are vulnerable to that kind of dynamic library injection bugs on OS X, which is a useful post-compromise trick, or for bypassing app whitelisting, that kind of thing. It's one of these things that you would expect an application store to check for. Mm. And I think, for those sort of the apps that are delivered through Apple's, App Store environment, you would expect this to be a thing that they would check for. And I imagine that's what will happen. For general purpose apps, I don't see it being a thing that's going to change particularly quickly.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we'll just see. Now, Google is apparently aware of a memory leakage bug in Android 5.1, and they say they're going to fix it. So there's that. Samsung has patched a real nasty one, and they've got like this social media unification app that comes out on Samsung Android, which, acts as a gateway to various social media things. It, generates tokens, and it's hideously vulnerable, and people can get the tokens. They finally patched that after a long delay. Good on them, but it shouldn't have taken them that long. And, using those sort of authentication aggregators like made by Samsung on Android, just don't. That's a really bad idea.
Yes. Don't do that.
Microsoft's update 3033929 is causing a reboot loop for a number of Windows 7 users. That's kind of annoying. Is that a security patch, that one?
Ironically, it's actually in the code signing section. So I assume you wouldn't change code signing unless it was security rated. But maybe they've found some unsigned code in the boot up and it's stuck in a reboot loop as a result. Bad.
Now, there's an OpenSSL patch out, according to Krebs on Security. Is this a planet melter? Is the world on fire again, or is this just a meh?
There is supposed to be some planet melting SSL bugs coming up. I haven't seen the specifics yet. I gather they're still fairly well embargoed after the mess that that Heartbleed was. But yes, I think we are all going to have to patch all of the SSL things and every one of those rubbish Android apps that compiles in their SSL that we were talking about earlier. They're also going to have to patch all their things too. So yes,
and the seven development houses who did the same for iOS apps.
Yes,
but well, no, maybe it was one development house
stealing ourselves.
Maybe it was one development house.
With that seven apps, perhaps.
Yeah,
so
there you go. Apple has also patched a boatload of WebKit vulnerabilities affecting Safari. D-Link has patched two remote exploits in its firmware. I'm mostly just surprised that they patched them at all. And Adobe has patched 11 security holes in Flash. Some of these affecting Windows and Mac. And funnily enough, a lot of the 0 days affecting them that have been caught in the wild were only... they only worked on IE and Windows, which is kind of interesting because the IE sandbox for Flash Player, not a real sandbox. And you're kind of thinking, well, why aren't they fixing that? And it's because they're about to ditch IE and bring in a new browser. So I'd expect that a lot of these will dry up when there's a decent Flash Player sandbox, in Windows.
Yeah, and of course their new browser project is going to be interesting to keep an eye on as well.
Yeah. All right, Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Thanks heaps for joining us. We won't chat to you next week because you're off to SciScan, but we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Yep, I'll look forward to talking to you then after I've been through hot and sticky Singapore.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news. Also, big thanks go out to Mark Fennell for his turn as our dystopian cyberpunk future newsreader. Thanks, mate. Really appreciate it. A quick correction, too, on last week's show. I said the Rowhammer research was done by Google Project Zero. It wasn't. The research was done by Googlers, but those guys didn't work on Project Zero. I got confused because they published the research on the Project Zero blog. Sorry for the confusion. Now, don't forget, you can now support the Risky Business podcast by signing up for a monthly patronage at patreon.com/riskybusiness. That's patreon.com/riskybusiness. You can contribute $1 a month, $100 a month, whatever you think the show is worth. I tend to think a buck an episode sounds about right. But you know what? This show is advertiser supported. So even if you don't want to, that's fine. We'll be fine. I'm just trying to raise a bit of extra money so I can actually set up a proper office and not go broke in the process. So do head to patreon.com/riskybusiness if you want to help me out. Okay, what else? Well, I did another YouTube video this week. You can head to risky.biz/rbtv3, all caps on that last bit. So it's risky.biz, then slash, and then all caps, rbtv3. And the basic theme of the video was we need to stop being so smug in the InfoSec industry and realize that, yes, things are a horrible mess. And yes, software companies do stupid things. And yes, technology users and enterprises do stupid things as well. But instead of the security industry adopting the role of a 7-year-old schoolyard bully by laughing at everyone when they get owned, maybe the InfoSec community should actually start fixing some of this shit. Radical thinking, I know. So I thought this week, in light of this video, it's a really good opportunity to look at the big picture and find out what some of the smarter people in the industry think needs to happen in order for things to get better. So we've got HD Moore on the show this week to pick up the theme. I wanted to hear from a prominent critical voice in the industry, and I asked him, basically, if he were king for a day, what would he do to fix things? And as you'll hear HD Moore say, improving software quality and implementing decent segmentation is going to get us a long way down the road, but, and this is a big but, he says until something truly catastrophic happens, no one is going to be motivated to actually do anything that he's suggesting. Hence our dystopian headline from the intro there. Anyway, here's HD Moore.
There is no real quality control for software these days. There really should be a minimum level of, you know, here's how resilient our software is, here's the maximum permissions it'll ever use, baked into desktop software used by every user. So at the very minimum, you'd put more liability on software vendors, which would, you know, definitely slow down internet, it'd slow down the growth, it'd slow down the entire economy around software and technology, but it's necessary. Otherwise, we're basically just hurtling free fall and waiting for the next breach to hit.
So you're talking about actual legal liability?
Some legal liability, but only if you don't meet at least some minimum bar. Today, I mean, you could be, you know, complete, have zero experience going straight out of college, writing what you consider to be, you know, secure server software and start selling it tomorrow, online, and no one's going to stop you. And no one should be able to stop you with the current free market, but there should at least be some certification that says your software is at least this good, or you at least do these minimum things to prevent a breach or to prevent code execution or another vulnerability from affecting your application. Right now, there is no minimum level of security. There is some basic stuff around cryptography with FIPS in the US, but that has actually no bearing on software security.
But I can think of at least one example where there is a minimum security standard set, right? That hasn't got us very far. And I'm thinking of PCI DSS, right? Because that hasn't really stopped credit card breaches from occurring, has it?
The way that a lot of folks approach compliance, whether it's PCI or HIPAA or anything else, is they try to reduce the scope of what's in scope as much as possible. And so what they do is say, okay, here's my entire enterprise network, which is full of, you know, holes and, you know, malwares on every desktop. Let's take all our PCI stuff and put it into a different room. Okay, done. Great. Well, now the admin has actually talked to that machine somehow. Okay, well, let's run a cable from the admin's PC back to the PCI network. Great. We're all set. We're all compliant. And that makes absolutely zero bit of difference because now the admin's machine can be compromised when the domain gets hacked. So there's a lot of things with how a lot of these regulations are phrased that allow people to kind of take the path of least resistance and end up making things just as bad as before.
Well, I mean, that's kind of my point, right? Is that even if you mandate some sort of level of minimum security for, you know, software products, surely you're going to wind up in a similar situation where they're like, yeah, technically we can tick that part off because we did this and it's in a ring binder somewhere, but you're going to actually wind up with very little real improvement. You're just going to wind up with a, you know, boom in compliance teams at software companies.
That's true. I mean, I guess I was looking at it more from a software manufacturer and device manufacturer standpoint. I mean, there's things that software developers are doing today, especially in the embedded space, that, you know, would be right at home in 1985. You're still seeing people using string copy and sprintf and just really basic unbounded functions for handling user input in all sorts of, you know, commercial production devices these days. The, you know, enterprise space and, you know, kind of the desktop software space have, for the most part, gotten rid of a lot of those. But we're still seeing, you know, that type of basic, you know, hey, don't use these API calls stuff being done, you know, in different areas, especially in different industry verticals.
But how could you actually introduce a minimum standard? How do you even begin to define a security level for software? How does that work?
Well, we're actually in a good spot for that. If you look at how the various app stores are being managed these days, from the Google App Store to Apple, they use a combination of, you know, manual analysis in some cases, but also a whole lot of static scanning. They say, what APIs do you call? Are you allowed to call those APIs? Are you requesting permissions to call those APIs? Moving to that kind of model for most enterprise software with not necessarily an app store model, but a model where there's at least some sort of static scanning or basic analysis happening that says, well, at least they didn't screw it up this way. That would cut back on a large portion of vulnerabilities and start letting you layer additional detections and behaviors on top of that, and to get to the point where you actually really have to be aiming at your foot to shoot it off.
Okay, so that covers off, sort of classes of security vulnerabilities. Say you drastically minimize them. It still only takes a misconfigured device on your network or some sort of logic bug that's still going to get you owned, right? And that static analysis isn't going to find you a logic bug, is it?
Oh, absolutely. Or bad passwords or anything else. I mean, there's still a lot of unsolved problems in security as it relates to user authentication and verification. I've been harping on this topic for years, but one thing that's a problem is if there's any device in your house that has network connectivity and you haven't applied an update to it in the last year, it's probably vulnerable and it's probably exploitable. And we see that again and again. If there's no way for the user to easily update a system, they're not going to update it. Microsoft found that out pretty easily. They had to basically force automatic updates by default before anyone would actually take the patches they built.
Yeah, and that was hugely controversial at the time because it was like people are like, "Oh my God, Microsoft want to execute code on my computer without asking me first." It was pretty funny, actually, in retrospect.
But at the same time, all the consumers went straight into the App Store model, where you're giving a lot more control than that each individual application vendor. So it's kind of funny to see the levels of trust are all over the map here.
Yeah, they sure are. So king for a day, as we were talking about, earlier, you're king for a day. You're the universal dictator of networks everywhere. So you're going to force software companies to reach a "you must be this high to enter" sort of bar. What else?
I mean, a big portion of security in general is segmentation, and users do a terrible job of segmenting their data from their applications and different things they do. They're going to use the same PC to play video games that they're going to use to access their corporate email. And the challenge of that is There's not a lot of isolation. All it takes is one bug in one of those systems to basically, get someone the keys to the kingdom. There's a lot of interesting work happening in virtualization where you can actually segment, different applications from each other. There's, Joanna's Cubes OS, which is a neat approach to solving the problem. And those types of things just need to get better. I mean, we're seeing sandboxing and segmentation really come into play in the mobile space because you do have these untrusted third-party applications that you don't want reading each other's data. So we're seeing a lot of good innovation happening in the mobile space for segmentation and isolation between processes and users. We need to see more of that happening at the desktop level.
What you're talking about in terms of forcing all users to segment off their different activities, and as you said, they're very bad at it, they're sort of going to resist these approaches. Is this something that a large organization can realistically be expected to do?
Not until it gets painless, right? Or it either has to be completely painless or they have to have no choice. And so we either have to wait till things get so bad that that is the only solution that is available and everyone has to move to it, or it has to be such a painless, transparent solution, overlay file systems, things like that, that users just don't notice it happening in the background.
So we'd have to wait for like nightmare scenarios like, the Iranian government hacking into major oil companies and disrupting their supply, or, crackpots in North Korea hacking into major film studios and causing huge damage to the film. Oh, hang on.
Unfortunately, no one cares about any of those things.
Billions of credit card details missing. That sort of thing, HD?
Well, Ceramco is great late night news. The Sony Pictures thing was a great, blog for people to go check on once in a while and say, "Hey, what's happening today with Sony?" But at the end of the day, consumers don't care. That wasn't really a lesson to anyone other than Sony and Saudi Aramco.
Well, maybe when, large health insurers start losing heaps of really personal information on like 100 million people. I mean, if something like that happens, surely things will change, right?
But only if it impacts the user in a way they actually care. If you look at credit card fraud, it just doesn't impact the users that much. The only type of massive financial fraud we're seeing that really hurts anybody are the ones that go after, thousands of different accounts and drain the banks themselves, or the ones that go after small businesses by either stealing deposits or hijacking accounts or redirecting wire transfers. But the average user isn't being hit. They don't really see the pains. They're not going to put any investment into finding ways around this or ways to protect themselves.
Yeah, I'm just wondering like how long it's going to be before they start experiencing that pain. I mean, it's always going to be a problem that affects institutions more than individuals, right? Because even if your bank gets hacked and someone starts fiddling with balances, the bank's going to make that right. That's their job. Essentially, banks are security companies. Give us your money, we will keep them safe. That's the whole premise of what they do. But we are starting to see attacks. And this was always the scenario, wasn't it, that we spoke about like 10 years ago, which is, you're not really going to hack the bank and transfer the balances around. You're going to hack the users. But we are starting to see that sort of approach from attackers now, aren't we? We are starting to see them go after the banks.
Yeah, the most recent, I forgot the name of the campaign in Russia, but that was a really good example of someone who really knew how the system worked and were able to move balances around before the, you know, weekly audits would catch it. And, you know, those are kind of the tax of the future, and those don't really have a whole lot of bearing on the consumers. Besides, oh my God, my bank is out of money. How do I get my money?
Well, that's a pretty big impact, man.
But I mean, everyone's underwritten and has enough insurance at this point that it's, you know, we're seeing a big rise of cybersecurity insurance as of this year. And that's just going to distance users even further from the risk of what they do online.
I'm just wondering if we could be hitting peak insecurity. Do you know what I mean? Like, at what point does something so catastrophic happen that this stuff starts getting taken seriously? I mean, do you need, you know, the number of incidents and the payouts to actually bring an insurance company down? I mean, would that do it?
Good question. I think it's, we'll have to wait and see, I guess. So wait another month.
But it is the question, isn't it? I mean, do we need to see a bank fail because enough balances have been transferred out that that bank is now insolvent? I know that sounds like a completely far-fetched, crazy dystopian thing, but so did Saudi Aramco. So did, you know, so did Sony.
A good example of that is, you know, that's happening all the time with Bitcoin exchanges. We're seeing Bitcoin exchanges going broke and running out of money and shutting down because they're getting hacked left and right. And that's kind of, you know, that may be a premonition of the future for how actual banks are going to handle things. Granted, there's more controls in place, more people, more resources and so on. But I think it's going to take until we get to that point before anybody takes it seriously. And I guess my gut feeling is that even then, the consumers still won't care. What's going to happen instead is either there'll be massive, you know, legal frameworks put in place to make the penalties for anything related to security research or hacking or anything else so abhorrent that you can't be anywhere near security without getting tainted by it. Or you're going to see really restrictive environments or networks being put in place where you can't access this environment unless you're within the United States and you use this kind of token and this kind of logon and this kind of that thing. But even still, if it's that much of a barrier to entry, they're going to lose their customers and therefore they're not going to do it. So there's a constant back and forth between pain to the consumer and market, you know, competitiveness and actual security measures that are in place.
At what point does it get real? What needs to happen? I'm thinking when a government somewhere has to bail out a bank that is failing because it got owned, that's when things might get real.
I guess I have a hard time seeing what would happen as a result of that. There really is no good response that I would expect to see as a result of even a major incident like that happening. I mean, the Anthem breach was a good example of this is as bad as it gets. This is the healthcare information for millions of folks, especially in the federal sector and defense sector, which includes all sorts of personal information, you know, lots of blackmail material, let alone, you know, what else. And yet the response was pretty much like, I'm sure Anthem really cares about it. I'm sure there's a lot of other folks in the healthcare space that are freaking out about it. But, you know, there isn't really any major reaction coming from consumers as a result. Like, no one knows what identity theft from healthcare information loss means yet. I mean, there's enough insurance, enough other folks to kind of catch the bag at this point that we haven't seen anyone, you know, at least I haven't seen anyone so far that has been completely out of business as a result of just a security breach. If you look at all the security breaches in the U.S. and look at the stock price of the companies that are involved, they might have gotten hit for a day or two and then it bounces right back up. It's basically seen as an opportunity to buy for people. I mean, that's how little anyone seems to care about the impact of security breaches. They think these are one-time issues that have been solved and go away, not realizing that all the data that particular company had that's now been lost is still out there. It's still being used, still being sold. Like, the long-term impact of these data breaches still isn't known.
So then if it's kind of impossible to fix it, because it does sort of seem like we're past the point where, you know, you can't just wave a pen, even if you're the dictator of the universe, and make all of this better.
Do you think we slow down, right?
Well, I mean, I'm just wondering if it's time to buy tinned food and ammunition. Do you know what I mean? Like, is it that bad?
No, I think if you look at the folks who've done it right in this industry in terms of software development and technology, they've been folks who have a whole lot to lose, that only have a couple shots of getting it right, and they have to spend all the time in the world to get it perfect every single time. So you look at folks like NASA, for example, the way they write their code for their systems. And the way they do that is they don't write very much code. They spend a whole lot of time deciding when to write 4 lines of code. And that means that as a business, they would never be competitive because they can't keep up with change. So we're going to see, you know, some sort of fracturing between the companies who want to keep up with the latest, hottest thing that's out there, and the companies who are going to differentiate themselves based on the stability and reliability of their software and services and security. And at this point, there isn't enough money in that latter camp to convince people to cross the line and say, no, we're going to do it right. We're going to go real slow. We're going to add all these different precautions in place. We're going to have, you know, all these various policies to make sure that this could never happen. Because you're still seeing companies just being too greedy from a technological sense and expanding everything they possibly can hand with the latest technology without really taking into account what the impact would be.
Well, I guess we haven't seen that terminal impact yet, have we? We haven't seen a company, you know, a major institution fail due to poor security. Do you think that will change things? Because I'm imagining, though, that it is possible in a greenfields sense. If you were given $1 billion and told, go make a network for this new bank that this, you know, fund is putting together, and we want the network to be secure, it would actually be possible to do that, wouldn't it, if you used very simple, the simple and correct choices?
Oh, absolutely. Then just don't touch it. Don't add anything to it. Don't change anything unless it's a bug fix. Basically, don't add new functionality. Don't connect to new third-party data sources. And that's the challenge that we're in, is if you're continuing to develop software faster than you can secure it, you're always going to be in a bad place.
So to bring this full circle, I mean, we started off this conversation going, well, you know, let's talk about this premise that it's sort of wrong of people in InfoSec to point and laugh at or be very judgmental about organizations that are getting owned. And it just seems like, you know, through the course of this conversation, we've established that insecure business practices are very much the norm and are entrenched for all sorts of complicated reasons. So do you think when your average pen tester laughs at the Sony breach or whatever getting owned through their crappy Citrix e-business solution, do you think maybe that laughing, that judgment is sort of like a cry for help in a world that's gone mad? Do you think that's where the psychological motivations come from?
I mean, I think anybody who sees these major breaches and laughs about it is probably laughing in some regards at themselves and somewhat nervously, because they realize that they do business with a lot of companies, maybe their own, that have similar problems. We breach us easily. I mean, a lot of the kind of humor you see in the information security industry is because everyone knows that could happen to them just as easily.
Mm. But to say you think it could be a frustrated cry for help?
To some extent. I think at this point, it's dark comedy at this point.
It's dark comedy at this point. All right. All right, HD Moore, thank you very much for joining the show to have a bit of a chat about what you would do if you were our global dictator for a day, and also, you know, where we could be heading in terms of pain points on the old internets. Cheers, mate.
Thanks, Pat. Was a blast.
Rapid7's very own HD Moore there with that. Thanks to him. Now, this week's sponsor interview is an absolute cracker. We're really lucky to have signed up Thinkst Applied Research to sponsor a couple of episodes. Thinkst are a very interesting company. They offer subscription-based research called Thinkstscapes. And I'm not talking about Gartner-style stuff or, you know, subscription zero-day. These guys do insight, basically. They release regular analysis and also do breakdowns of what's been happening at conferences. And the thousands of conference presentations that happen every year in the InfoSec industry. They can help you understand what you should care about, basically. You can subscribe to that service, and if you're a large enterprise, I'd encourage you to think about it. It's a paid service, but do check that out, Thinkstscapes. I'll drop a link into this week's show notes. Thinkst also runs Fish5, which is an automated phishing service that you can use to phish your own employees for training purposes. It works extremely well. It's really easy to use, and it's so very much cheaper than much of the competition. A lot of blue chip brands use Fish5. Fish5 is awesome. Check it out at fish5.com. That's P-H-I-S-H-5.com. So Thinkst principal, Harun Mir, who's, you know, quite a well-known chappy in his own right, joins us now to continue our discussion of the big picture. When we spoke, he'd just finished doing the opening keynote at the Troopers Conference in Frankfurt. And funnily enough, his keynote dovetails pretty much perfectly with the video that I did this week and the interview that I did with HD. From a big picture point of view, Harun says the biggest challenge to IT security, to information security, is complexity. Here's what he had to say.
Yes, so the complexity problem's been raised by a few people. And one of the interesting things is Bruce Schneier has this post that you can go check out on his site. And he's talking about how things are just going to get more and more complex. And the more complex they are, the harder they are to defend. And it's what makes the post interesting is that Schneier wrote it in 1999. And he, at that point, he's basically saying, look, there's two ways this can go. Either we forcibly kill functionality and stuff, or we're going to have this problem run away from us. And I think if anyone looks at it honestly, at this point, it's run away from us. Like we spent a whole 15 years with people learning how to attack the processor in your machine. And suddenly you're starting to find out that there's not a processor in your machine, right? Like you've got multiple machines running in every machine of yours. So there's this guy from SpritesMod who recently went spelunking on hard drives. And he comes out with, like, you've got three microprocessors, three useful cores just on your hard drive controller. And in the end, he did awesome research. He's literally loaded and running Linux.
Yeah, I saw that talk in Melbourne at Breakpoint a couple of years back.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was cool. And recently, the OS X dev guys basically found out that the DV adapters have a system on a chip with 2 gigs of RAM running in that thing that you think is your VGA adapter. And the stuff's kind of ridiculous. Like Bunny and Zobs found out on micro SD cards, there's like 100 megahertz processor running that gets put on there for 30 cents. But they could find it and they could own it and they could man in the middle it. And FX has this this nice paper out where he basically says, look, we keep talking about security like it's independent systems, but security is composable, and this is where our problem is, that the attackers are not just going to hit you at individual systems. They're always going to hit you where they can. And with composable systems, everything's a gate. And at this point, the complexity of it all is just nuts, and it's pretty indefensible.
Well, I mean, even if we just look at something like an operating system in a browser stack, that's not a problem we've been able to solve. So even setting aside the fact that there are processors and onboard computers everywhere, you know, we were chatting before we hit record, and, you know, you pointed out that Microsoft has invested squillions upon squillions of dollars in their security. They're doing it right. They're held up as the model organization for responding to bugs and patching bugs and building good infrastructure that way. And they had 42 bugs in Internet Explorer this February.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Like 42 bugs, and those are high severity exploitable bugs in Internet Explorer. And like, you get to a point where you say, like, look, if these guys can't get it right, then we're gonna have to do a reboot and say, look, this stuff's too hard to get done right. And internet security vendors are notoriously bad for this. Like, Veracode pushed out a report at some point with where they classified stuff by industry vertical. And the security vendors came second only to, like, CMS makers for how bad our code is. Like,
I think there is a, you know, in defense of security software does have, I mean, it parses more content types than a browser. You know what I mean? So it's attackable stuff by nature.
Yeah, I hear it, but I really don't think we can be selling our stuff as security software when we opening up and adding to people's attack surface. Like, you know, you had one job, like,
yeah.
like come on.
Well, it is interesting because, you know, as we just heard from H.D. Moore, he said that in the future, organizations may start differentiating themselves based on the ones that take a simpler approach and, you know, sort of use security as a differentiator. I mean, this is further along down the track when we're seeing even more horrible incidents and even more rotten stuff go wrong. Do you think that that's a possibility, that people will start chopping down and going just for the tech that they need, not the current standard?
Yeah, so I think a lot of things, a lot of stars are aligning to help make that stuff happen. Like in a way, the 90s were, your software was better if it had more features, and suddenly we started getting used to text editors that just had a text button, and we got simpler interfaces and simpler devices. And now if you take a locked Chromebook or a locked iPhone, like, there's more than a few people who are figuring out that, listen, this general purpose computer stuff is not easily securable. And I think you're going to bump into the libertarians there. Like Dan Gere's been saying for a while, that at some point we're going to have more security than we want. And I think that's kind of the path we're going to go to, and that's a bridge we're going to have to cross when we get there.
Now, one of the reasons you say, or that you've argued in this keynote that we've gotten there, and it's funny because I just did a video on this this week, is that, you know, we've spent, the security industry has focused its best people, it's targeted its best people at conducting offensive research. The idea was that by exposing all of these problems in software, in networks and things like that, that people would learn from that example, and they haven't. Do you think the emphasis on offense is actually getting us anywhere?
Yeah, it's super interesting. And look, I spent a lot of my time in exactly that same spot. So doing offensive stuff and finding new tricks to do badness. And no, I think we've ended up going down kind of a wrong path with it. And in this talk, I kind of have a slide where I say we've been doing all of this research for customers that we kind of wish we had. So I pick on an IOActive blog post for some really cool research that they did. And K2 basically did this stuff where you're trying to find DCOM rootkits in memory. In honesty, in the last 15 years, I just haven't had that many customers for whom DCOM rootkits in memory are a problem. Like, if you're honest, most of the clients you're going to have, their DBA is going to walk out tomorrow and they've got no idea how much badness he's done. Like, find a way so that a large company can get rid of a DBA without being hosed, and then you've solved an interesting problem for the organizations. Find a way that they can terminate a sysadmin and actually know that their systems are not going to melt down in an hour, and that's an interesting problem.
But that is not as sexy as Rowhammer.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem. So I think it's true that it's not as sexy, but I think one of the things that a bunch of smart people are starting to realize is that they also hard problems. Like it's not hard in the same way, but if you signed up for solving hard problems, there's a bunch of hard problems that need solving that aren't maybe memory corruption, but it's a problem that hasn't been solved for 20 years.
And you're talking about, and this was a big theme of your talk, you're talking about organizational dysfunction here, aren't you?
Yeah, so I think organizational dysfunction is a big part of it. And I think we're going to have to do some serious thinking about some of that stuff. Because I think we act like the organizational dysfunction's not there. And some of that dysfunction's there by design. And security, we kind of snuck into organizations. So we've got a bit
it's
of
a nice
entitled
little network you got here. It would be a shame if anything were to happen to it. Yeah, that sort of thing,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. And we kind of rode in on headlines, right? So at some point the board figured out, hey, we need the security stuff, and they started paying us. And one of the things that I've been hammering on for a while, and I say it in this talk also, and interestingly, it got a bit of ire on the Twitters for people who are annoyed with me for saying it, is there are parts of this organizational stuff that we totally don't get. Like, I don't know how anyone's doing reasonable risk calculations. So, you know, you have these guys who throw up good AIL equations like expected loss and expected benefit and that stuff. And there's this massive, massive gap between people who understand the organization and people who understand how bad tech problems can get. So for example, if I go out on a limb, I'm willing to bet that most boards of most companies do not know that their lowly paid DBA has access to the stuff he has access to. Or most people at the board level have no way of knowing that their help desk 40K a year guy can reset the exchange administrator's password and read everyone's email. Like, there's no way for them to connect those dots. And I think if boards knew that stuff, they'd freak out. Like they don't know how bad those things are. And for us, we kind of blasé about it because we were reading people's mails when we were running mail servers in data centers. And it's like, yeah, we know that stuff happens. But these two things are colliding because boards have been paying us big money for the last 15 years. And they think we're on top of this stuff. And we're just not. Like nobody's got them figured out yet.
So as an industry, and this is where I get interested, as an industry, what is it that we do? I mean, one of the things that comes up a lot is segmentation, you know, actually separating users' fun play area from their actual work area. There's a whole bunch of tools coming out. I mean, you've seen Cubes, we've got Bromium, we've got others that are actually, you know, in this space. Do you think that technology holds much promise?
In terms of Bromium, Cubes, and that stuff, I think they're awesome technology. But I think they're going to be hell to squeeze into an organization. And in part because of this horrible organizational dysfunction. Like, I was a sysadmin many, many moons ago. And kind of to date it, I spent all my time back then on Novell's TID homepage. Like, for almost every problem I had in my life, there was a Novell TID that I would look up that would help me troubleshoot it. And if you look at help desk guys today, they live on Exchange and TechNet pages. because that's their job, right? Make this user problem go away. And now some dude from security says that your base OS should be running on cubes, which maybe has a good FAQ page written by Joanna Rutkowska. Like, do you really think that's going to fly in that organization where the guy lives and dies on TechNet? And even if you've got great technology like Bromium or Invincia or any of that stuff, you've got this dichotomy where you're selling it to the security guys, but there's just this massive split incentive model where the guys who need to keep desktops running every day, they live and die by what Microsoft says because that's what decreases their mean time to solve problems. And so even if you get technically smart solutions, making a solution that survives in the enterprise is going to be a different kettle of fish. And I think security has just been bad at playing that game. A little bit, it comes back to what I was saying about our entitlement culture. Like, security also marches around companies with a security needs to be involved. People need to involve us in decisions. And nobody else does that. Like if you're a lame marketing department, the company will work without you. They'll go to external vendors. Mm. They'll use Ogilvy. But security has this thing that says, involve us, like dial us in. And no, that just doesn't work for any department.
So where does that leave us? I mean, does that mean it's going to be less about the, you know, doing it right is going to mean less using point solutions and fancy security technology and more about stripping things back? I mean, do you think we're at the point where in a year or 2 years from now, I mean, already we've seen things like Saudi Aramco, we've seen the Sands attacks in Las Vegas, you know, we've seen the Sony breach, things like that. Do you think it'll get to the point where these things are going to escalate and the headlines are going to get more and more outrageous every day until finally some brave CEO out there says, that's it, it, you know, we're going to lock down our network and only provide extremely simple basic tech, the bare minimum that we need, and we're going to lock that down. Do you think this is a realistic scenario?
I think we're going to get there sooner than people think. Like, I think once like stuff like Chromebooks or limited computing devices start coming in, look, I
because they're all consumer devices at the moment, aren't they? I mean, how long is it going to be before we see an enterprise-focused, basic, dumb device?
Yeah, I don't think that's going to take too long. I think like most things, it'll happen slowly at first and then all of a sudden. Mm. And I think the problem is so big that it pushes us there. Look, the one ray of hope is I think this whole thing of point solutions, like I think they're good products waiting to be built. But like I say, I think we've spent all our time finding out how to optimize our ROP chains.
Yeah, this is what I was going to get at. I mean, do you think that some of these incredibly smart people in the industry need to perhaps refocus their attention on building some really simple, specific use computing devices that enterprises can actually use effectively?
Yeah, well, I think it's simple use effect computing devices. I even think there's simple problems like password management. If you spend 5 minutes in a big enterprise, like this is a stupid problem that they don't have solved. Like how do they share passwords? How do they share local admin passwords? You go to large companies today and their execs aren't running a password manager. You almost want to say, what are your security team doing? Like, and really I think where the hope for us lies is in security getting a little bit more empathetic to people's problems. Like instead of going, you idiots, you shared passwords, figuring out, well, they're sharing passwords because they don't have a good solution. Let's build them a good solution to handle this password thing. Like I think it's kind of telling that some of the best password manager tools that exist out there, like I use 1Password. I love it. I think it's awesome. And it wasn't made by security guys at all. Like it was a Mac OS X development house. And they've done more for security than some of the security consultancies that I've been calling friends for years, just by putting something useful and usable out there.
Well, it does seem too that when people from the pen testing industry or the offense industry actually turn to building solutions, they generally do okay. They tend to make a lot of money. I mean, Duo Security is an example. You got Veracode as well as an example. I mean, there are fistfuls of cash out there and people just would prefer to work on their offensive stuff, it seems.
Yeah, I think the offensive stuff, much like my soapbox about security talks, have been giving us dopamine hits for a long time. And I think you're starting to see that turn. Like you said with Duo, you're seeing it with Zane Lackey and the Signal Sciences guys. You're seeing it with Dino Dizovi. You're starting to see really traditionally smart, traditionally offense-focused guys saying, hold on, let's see if we can take a crack at this defense slash solution stuff. And in truth, one of the things that I kind of added at the tail end of my talk, like when I started this stuff in again, it dates me, like the late 90s, like we genuinely believed this is where the smart people were going. Like the hard problem was, can you break into networks? And kind of 20 years later, like, yeah, you break into networks. Like you aim at a network and you break into it. And we're not even the apex predators anymore, right? Like you want to do that stuff nicely, you need fashion cleft and you need to be sniffing every pipe that crosses the Atlantic. And now you can do awesome ownage. And if you're not playing that game, then try this defense stuff. Like sign up and throw your hat in the ring and let's see if you can actually dent the problems that are out there.
Well, I mean, that's the challenge, I guess, for people out there who may be listening. You know, get involved, get amongst it, as they say. Haroon Mir, thank you so much for joining us on the show to recap your Troopers keynote. It's been fascinating.
Thanks a lot, Patrick.
Haroon Mir of Thinkst there. Big thanks to Thinkst. And I've dropped a link in this week's show notes to the Thinkstscapes page and to Fish 5. You should totally buy their stuff because they are, in fact, awesome. And that is it for this week's show. This week's track is a fun one. It's UMI singer Tim Rogers. You know, you heard a bit of UMI last week. But in this week's track, he's singing with the Bamboos, a fine, fine Aussie band from Melbourne. The track is called I Got Burned. Get it on iTunes. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.